From the KBIA Newsroom in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Sarah Shariari. This week on Intersection, we're exploring African American history in Missouri, with a special emphasis on Columbia. Our guests are UMKC professor and historian Diane Moody Burke, and MU doctoral student in history Mary Beth Brown. Diane Moody Burke is author of the book On Slavery's Border, Missouri Small Slaveholding Households, 1815 to 1865. The issue of slavery was fundamental even in the formation of Missouri as a state. Could you talk about that?
Well, of course, there was some famous or infamous, I guess, Missouri Compromise that was basically the Congress trying to decide whether or not Missouri would enter as a slave state. And it was a long, long debate. I mean, really, they were fighting about it pretty, I mean, it was a huge fight for about a year in Congress trying to determine whether or not Missouri would enter as a slave state. And it was kind of surprising to Southerners, because up until that point, there really hadn't been a whole lot of debate about that at the national level. If, you know, a state wanted to enter as a slave state, nobody really complained about it. But, you know, it was kind of the beginnings of the abolition movement in the North, and there were some Northern congressmen who did not want to see that happen. Some of them, it was for humanitarian reasons, but for a lot of them, it was really for political reasons. They were concerned about the growing power of politicians from the slave states. They didn't want to see, you know, another slave state enter the Union because of that. And so they fought quite hard about it. Now, the interesting thing about it is they didn't really ask Missourians what they thought about it. You know, this is really a debate and a fight that was going on at the national level. The fact is, if they'd come out here to Missouri and interviewed people, they would have found that most of them very strongly supported Missouri as a slave state. And that's because, you know, most of the early settlers were from places where slavery had existed. They were either French settlers or people of French descent. There had been slavery in Missouri well before Americans were ever involved. The French had had slaves here, both working in agriculture and, of course, domestic labor, but also in mining operations in southeastern Missouri. So they had been here for a long time, and they had had African and Indian slaves, Native American slaves. But then also most of the early settlers who had moved from America had come from places like Kentucky and Virginia, Tennessee, and they either owned slaves or they were supportive of slavery because maybe they thought that someday they would own slaves. So they would have supported it pretty, I think, stridently, but they weren't really asked whether or not slavery should exist in Missouri. So what ultimately ended up happening was there was the famous compromise where Maine came in as a free state and Missouri came in as a slave state, and then they continued to balance that out up through the Mexican War, where every time a free state entered, a slave state entered. So it kept the balance of power the same within the Senate.
I think many people's ideas of slavery revolve around the image of a large plantation, but that's not really what slavery looked like for the most part in Missouri.
Only a fraction of people owned many, many slaves, hundreds of slaves. Most people throughout the South owned only a few slaves. But in a place like Missouri, that was overwhelmingly the case. There were very few large planters. Here, people who owned 20-plus slaves there were certainly people who did, but they were not nearly as numerous as in other states and other slave states. So size was a real factor. And, you know, what my research does is explore how that created some differences. Now, fundamentally, at the bottom of it, it is slavery. And, you know, with every bit as harsh and as horrible as it was anywhere else. But it did create a little bit of a variation in the experience for enslaved people, in a place like Missouri because these the slave holdings were smaller, and because Missouri was located, you know, surrounded essentially by free states, and that made a little bit of a difference as well.
Missouri was surrounded by areas free of slavery. How did that affect people here? Did it make it easier for enslaved people to escape?
Well, you know, the proximity to free states and territories obviously made it a little bit easier for people to run away successfully. But what we know is that in most cases, you know, most enslaved people who ran away did not get away successfully. So being close to a free state did not guarantee that. First off, you had to get outside of your own community. And in a place like Missouri, people tended to know one another. So they knew when somebody looked like they didn't belong, that they had come from someplace else, and they would question them. So that was one thing. It was very difficult to get out of the state of Missouri itself. But then even after you got into those free states and territories, there was no guarantee that you would successfully escape, because there were people in all of those places who were willing and interested in capturing fugitives and returning them back to their to the people who claim them in a place like Missouri. And after the Fugitive Slave Law was passed as part of the Compromise of 1850, they were compensated quite handsomely for doing that. So there was a monetary reward for sending people back. And a lot of people decided that they wanted to capitalize on that. So it was very, very difficult to get away. But having said that, I mean, the chances of getting away from Missouri were greater than getting away from Mississippi. You know, where are you going to run to if you live in Mississippi or surrounded by other slave states? So it did increase the odds, you know, fairly significantly. The other thing it did is that it created a tremendous sense of paranoia among white Missourians, especially those who owned enslaved people. They were very, very worried that their slaves would run away, especially if they lived along the border. And it really explains, I think, in a lot of ways, their sort of heightened sense of paranoia and even hysteria. As the Civil War approached and things like, you know, Bleeding Kansas happened, you know, they were fighting over whether or not Kansas would be a slave or a free state. And especially those people who lived in western Missouri, they were very concerned that it would make slavery vulnerable, that their slaves would escape, that perhaps what they would consider outside agitators would come into the state of Missouri, you know, people who had anti-slavery views who might entice their slaves to run away or might try to encourage them to rebel. I mean, these were the kinds of things that they worried about. And that didn't happen very often. It did occasionally, and there were some sort of famous cases of it, but it didn't happen very often, and it was kind of overblown. But in their minds, they thought it was real.
During the Civil War, Missouri didn't leave the Union. How did that affect the situation on the ground?
Missouri was a border state, and what that means is it was a slave state that that was bordered by free states. And so during the Civil War itself, there were three states, Missouri, Kentucky, and Maryland, where the people within those states decided not to secede from the Union officially. But there was a fairly significant portion of people who supported the South. So those three states became very internally divided politically during the war. And in Missouri, that played out in all sorts of really interesting ways. Essentially, what happened is the Union military, which there had always been a strong federal military presence in St. Louis, they swept out of St. Louis in the early years of the war, and by the end of the first year of the war, had essentially pushed out of the state pro-Southern forces, which were really Missouri state forces, but they forced them out of the state, as well as the sitting governor of the state. And then the Union Army occupied large parts of Missouri during the war, especially in the river counties, where there was a more sizable pro-Southern population of white Missourians. And why that's important is that it created, you know, really interesting and troubling things that happened in Missouri. For one thing, there was a very large guerrilla insurgency that developed in the state of Missouri. And they were pro-Southern, and what they were most focused on was targeting those Union troops who were stationed throughout the countryside. But they also targeted white Missourians who supported the Union, and there were quite a few of them. In fact, interestingly, some slaveholding white Missourians who supported the Union. They targeted them, but they also targeted African Americans. They targeted enslaved people, and especially enslaved people who were trying to get away from slavery, which starts to happen very early in Missouri, really as early as the summer of 1861. They see the opportunity that these Union troops provide, and the fact that the white population is divided politically, so they really understand this. And they recognize this as an opportunity for their own freedom way before most people in America were starting to think about the Civil War as a war for emancipation. They thought of it that way. And they started to run away to these Union military encampments. They started to run out of the state, so to places like Kansas and into Illinois, where they reasoned that somebody might help them. And, you know, while, again, it was not a guarantee, it wasn't even a guarantee during the Civil War, there was that possibility that somebody might help them in these places, and they recognized that, and they went in large numbers, mostly men at first, but then later on, women and children as well. And this is really a game changer in Missouri, because it means that slavery starts to disintegrate internally. I mean, it's happening, it's collapsing within the state. And white Missourians are really concerned about this. They really start to use the guerrillas who are operating in the, mostly in the countryside. They start to use them essentially as a slave patrol, because the slave patrols, which were kind of run by county governments, had, as county governments disintegrated during the war because there was so much there was so much violence and tension within these communities. Those had disintegrated, and so the slave or the guerrillas sort of step in into this role, and they're patrolling the roads to make sure people aren't running away. They become especially concerned when enslaved men start to run away to join the Union Army, which they're able to do in Missouri. A little over halfway through the war, they start to enlist in the Union Army once they're allowed to within the state. So they want to stop them. And what it does is it creates a situation where the countryside is very unstable, and it's a very scary place to be. I mean, really for everyone, both white and black Missourians. So it creates a situation where African Americans, as they run away from slavery, they end up moving into urban areas in very large numbers. And this could just mean a place like Columbia or Marshall, Missouri, you know, a place where the Union Army was garrisoned because they thought that they would be protected there. And in some cases, they actually were. But they also start to move into cities like St. Louis, which becomes the place where all of these Union soldiers are mustered into the Union Army. So they end up going into St. Louis. They also start to move into Kansas City. And because a lot of the violence continues, even in the years after the war, people stay there. So the countryside is not totally depopulated of African Americans, not it's not at all. But the percentage of people who had been there in the countryside in 1860 decreases in 1870, if you look at the census. I mean, there is really an urbanization of the African American community in a place like Missouri. And this did happen in other border states as well, from what I understand. But it looks very different than what the way that things look down in the deeper South, in a place like Georgia or Mississippi or Alabama. So it's a really interesting part to the story, I think.
That was UMKC professor and historian Diane Moody Burke, who is author of the book On Slavery's Border, Missouri's Small Slaveholding Households, 1815 to 1865. So the Civil War ends. Formerly enslaved Missourians are free, and people have moved toward cities. Now let's fast forward a few decades and focus our attention on Colombia. This past weekend, I went on a bus tour of historic Black Colombia, guided by MU doctoral student Mary Beth Brown. We were looking for the places and talking about the people that were key parts of Colombia's African-American community from the early 1900s onward. When we were up near the cemetery, this is something I didn't know before, but you were talking about how there was a pretty big Black community in Cemetery Hill, which we now know as the parking lot outside Lucky's and the office supply store.
Yeah, Cemetery Hill was one of the forming areas in where members of the Black community lived in Colombia throughout the 20th century. Its boundaries were Lancaster and the MKT railroad tracks, Cherry Street and Water Street, and Cemetery Road. And it's hard to picture, but when Cemetery Hill was there before it was torn down in the late 1950s, Providence, which was 3rd Street, didn't go all the way through. So it ended right past Broadway, and then after that it was a dirt or cinder road. And so bordering along the cemetery was a group of what some people just describe as shacks, but there were some homes that were rented by members of the Black community. And then as part of the efforts to combat what the city considered blighted areas and slum clearance, Cemetery Hill and Douglas School Urban, or the Douglas School area, were targeted for slum clearance, or as part of the slum clearance project. The city decided not to focus on Cemetery Hill because they figured private developers would do it, since it was going to be along that major thoroughfare that would go from the north part of the city to the south part of the city.
And you were remarking that there were actually quite a lot of homes and families in that area.
There were. At one point, when they started moving the homes out, there were some members of the community who were questioning where the Black residents were going to go to if their homes were torn down. So a woman named Helen Cray wrote the mayor and city council about this issue, and she really started the conversation, or seemed to have started the conversation, about what to do with the displaced people. And they helped, I don't know that they helped them find places, but they talked about what to do or what types of structures they could put up in the area for the people to go to. And I do know that some of the houses were actually physically, and I think these were more that were down towards the corner of Broadway and 3rd Street, were actually physically moved over in the Garth area.
It's amazing to think that at some point there was no South Providence. And this is not like the distant past. I mean,
No. There
are certainly people who remember a neighborhood being there and no road going past down South Providence.
It was actually the South Providence area right through there, what we know as the Flat Branch Park area and stuff, was actually a pretty industrial area for a long time.
And quite near there was the old Stewart Bridge, which is the scene of the last lynching in Colombia. And that happened in the 1923. Can you tell us a little bit about that event?
Yes, and I can't do the justice that other scholars like Doug Hunt have done. But a young girl, a 14-year-old Regina Olmsted, was attacked along Stewart Road Bridge, or underneath Stewart Road Bridge, on April 20th, 1923. And she was able to escape, and she was able to describe her assailant to her parents and the police as a Black man who was 25 to 30 years old, with a mustache like Charlie Chaplin and clothes that gave off a strong chemical odor. And the police arrested James Scott, who was a janitor who worked for the University School of Medicine. And once she identified him, he was charged with assault and then put in jail at the Boone County Courthouse. And on Saturday evening, April 28th, 1923, a mob gathered outside the courthouse calling for Scott, and they were finally able to get into the jail, and they took Scott and removed him out and took him back down to underneath the Stewart Road Bridge where Regina Olmsted had gotten attacked. And along the way, his lawyer had tried to call the governor for help, and the National Guard was called out to offer aid, but they didn't make it to Colombia. The judge tried to intervene and get the mob to let justice run its course, but they wouldn't listen. And then they took him down to the Stewart Road Bridge, and he proclaimed his innocence several times, and actually said that it was Ollie Watson, who was his cellmate, who had attacked Regina Olmsted. Herman Olmsted, who was a university professor and Regina's father, tried to keep the lynching from happening because he said he wanted to see justice done in the courts. And the mob threatened to lynch him as well, so he stopped trying. Mm-hmm. And then they hung Scott over the south side of the bridge. They did arrest and charge George Barkwell and four others with the... Well, Barkwell was charged with first-degree murder, and four others were charged with obstructing an officer, but Barkwell was eventually acquitted, and then they dropped the charges from the other defendants.
So really, nothing. It just sort of disappeared. And I think from the bridge, we went into campus and you talked about student activism. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion of student activism, especially this year on campus with the graduate students and Concerned Student 1950. But you were talking about a group called CORE.
Yes, it had two different names. It was first Committee on Racial Equality, and then it became the Congress on Racial Equality. So they actually had two different names at different points. But they were a national organization. They actually did a lot of, they had chapters. They weren't really called chapters. They were kind of affiliate groups at different places and in different cities. And a lot of the early ones were in different college, on college campuses around the country. And a lot of the early efforts, the national early efforts were in places like Chicago, or there were a lot in Ohio. So they were in the North and not necessarily the South, where we traditionally put student civil rights activism as starting. And in 1959, a group of MU students formed a group. It was an interracial group of students, mainly men from the men's dorms, but they formed a group of CORE, but they weren't yet affiliated with the national organization. So first they became affiliated on campus and recognized as a campus organization, and then they got national affiliation with the group, but they still went by the name CORE even in the early days. And they started out and they targeted the Tiger Inn, which was at the corner of 6th and Elm, because they said that their policies regarding serving Black students or any members of the Black community were very erratic. Sometimes they would serve him, sometimes they wouldn't. And one man in particular, Bob Hansen, who was a senior who was Caucasian, he kind of led the effort. And because the Black students had... It was right across the street from the door, the residence hall, so it was a convenient place for them to go eat. And if they couldn't go eat, then they couldn't all go together. So they started to set up demonstrations outside and to boycott the Tiger Inn and try to get other students to boycott, because the majority of the business was students coming from across the street. So they started that in May, and not sure how long the boycotts how long they continued boycotting at that location, but it was definitely still going on after a week. And then they also moved on to, in 1959, during May, and during that next semester, they started going to other restaurants in town, trying to get them to change their serving policies and serve everybody instead of just white residents.
So until 1964, was Columbia officially segregated, or how did that work at that time?
There were no official Jim Crow laws on the books that I know of, but as far as I'm aware, it was up to individual business owners. There were some places that served everybody. I know when Gus Ridgel and the other nine students started attending MU in 1950, that they were served, they were able to eat off campus at the bookstores, the Missouri bookstores counter. I believe that's the only place that I've read that Gus Ridgel said that they could go to eat. And then also those students also would go over to Sharp End and eat at some of the restaurants that were located there, which served members of the Black community.
And it's amazing. I mean, I've heard about Sharp End. I think a lot of people in Columbia have, but I wasn't quite sure exactly where it was. And really, when you go to what was Sharp End now, I think you just see the ground, some businesses and a really big parking garage and the post office. What would Sharp End have looked like in 1950?
Throughout the 1950s, they had many different businesses. It's fun to look at the city directories and the street index and see how the business has changed and then what also stayed the same. One of the longtime businesses was Williams and Phillips Barbers.
And Urban Renewal was a nationwide, federally funded policy to sort of
tear down blighted areas, but it had a really huge impact on the African American community in a lot of different places. Why Sharp End? I mean, it doesn't sound as though it was blighted.
Well, Sharp End, the block along Walnut Street, was the southernmost border on that part of the urban renewal map, the redevelopment map. I've never seen a solid explanation of why Sharp End was included. There were some other businesses along 8th Street that were included that were white-owned businesses, and they were included to make, there was a parking lot that was placed there. And then Sharp End, the south side of the street, was also made into a parking lot that was a planned parking lot at the time. So I've read things that the city were trying to increase their tax revenues from some of the areas that they were redeveloping, but I don't know if it was pre-planned for the post office to be there, if that's where the government said we want to put the post office there. So I don't know.
And so you have obviously dedicated a great deal of time to this study. You're a student of history yourself. Why is this important to you?
When I was working at Western Historical Manuscript Collection, I served on the university's Black History Month committee. And one year we were talking about programs for that Black History Month. And somebody said it would be really neat to do a walking tour of Black Columbia. And I had done a little bit of research. I wasn't really doing a lot of public programs at that point. But I had done enough research on Columbia to know that most of the places people would want to talk about and would want to see were no longer there. So I came up with the idea to do a virtual walking tour of historic Black Columbia. And so At the time, I did not know near as much and had not talked to as many people as I have now. So looking back, it's a very simplistic tour of the area, but it highlighted the people we all hear a lot about, like Blind Boone, just very basic urban renewal, and Sharp End. I did include Annie Fisher because I had already been studying her and researching her life, and Cemetery Hill because I knew about the empty Osco lot at that time. So after doing that, I started meeting people in the community and sharing stories. They began sharing stories with me, and I was able to do more of the personal side of urban renewal and not just talk about what the city's plan was done and what the city reported in the newspapers.
That was MU doctoral student in history, Mary Beth Brown, who has led tours on historic Black Columbia. Thank you for spending your time with us here at Intersection, conversations in our community. I want to thank our producers, Katie Eisterhold, Carlo Canta, and Amanda Beiler. And of course, thank you to our guests, UMKC history professor Diane Moody Burke and MU doctoral student in history, Mary Beth Brown. Our music is Montana Skies. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection here on KBIA 91.3 FM.